This is Breaking Down Security, and I am Brian Brake. Welcome back, listener. This is Brian from Breaking Down Security. Mr. Berlin will be on our show a little later. We're doing some audio from when she went to B-Sides Wellington back in the last week in November. And Mr. Betcher's off for this week. So, friend of mine, Jay Beal, and I attended HushCon, which is an interesting InfoSec con here in the Seattle area. They have a HushCon East, which is somewhere on the East Coast. I don't want to say it's in like Boston or something like that. You can look it up on their website, hushcon.com. Wanted to sit down with Jay and find out what his thoughts about HushCon were, some of the talks that were given. HushCon's interesting in that it is much like the Sky Talks at DEF CON, where the talks are not recorded, so it gives speakers a little more leeway. They don't have to be so political. They don't have to worry about who they might offend, or you know, if they decide to drop some ODE, then they can. Also, that means that I could not actually record, or I did not feel like I could record audio even outside the building. They did have requirements not to record anything inside the building, so I wanted to record something outside, but due to time constraints and it being 35 degrees here in the Seattle area, I decided to not do that. So got with my friend Jay Beal from Guardians, of course, sat down on a Zoom and discussed, you know, the talks at HushCon, some of the news about Google releasing an ODE for iOS, which is exciting for the jailbreaking community of iOS. And I asked him some questions about our show last week about the DFAIR hierarchy and, you know, what he sees with organizations when he goes in, and, you know, what are some necessary takeaways that they could get from the DFAIR hierarchy. And I suggest, you know, for better context, that you go and listen to last week's show about that if you have any questions. So I began by asking Jay what he thought about the talks at HushCon.
I didn't. I saw, so, and honestly, the way I do conferences, at a lot of conferences, I solely do the hallway con. You know, yeah. Like I give my talk and then I manage to like see one or two in person, and the rest I have to just catch later on the recording. So if mm-hmm. you're doing something like HushCon, I'm gonna miss out.
Right.
Topics, I kind of did some brainstorming about things that I'd bring up. One was that there's a new iOS jailbreak for the first time in a long time.
I saw that.
And that was Google Project Zero member Ian Beer, who's their iOS guy, mm-hmm. Basically released a vulnerability. And that never happens because a vulnerability that will get you code execution and basically lead to a jailbreak generally runs about $1 million, $1.5 million now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's an odd way of making the iPhone a much, much safer phone than an Android phone, is that the exploits are worth so freaking much.
Yep.
That anybody who gets one sells it to a government or sells it to, you know, somebody who uses it sparingly.
Yep.
So that they don't get detected. And even if they used it widely, the nice thing is they don't seem to use it widely enough for anybody else to pick it up. So your attacker set is, you know, some small number of entities in the world instead of, you know, everyone who can get their hands on an exploit.
Yeah, so. I saw that. Not only is there, you know, jailbreaks becoming harder to come by, but you know, it's coming to the point where iOS devices repos, like they just had one closed just recently because they were like, well, you know, there hasn't been a good one for a recent version of OS in a year. So, you know, we're shutting down.
Yeah. Which, their user base is shrinking massively,
which is ironic because Google still has, you know, they actually, I wouldn't say encourage the open source or jailbreaking, but you know, there's Lineage OS, which was a CyanogenMod derivative. You know, yep. There's still a lot of handsets out there that are, you know, rootable. Actually, I used to buy my my devices and how easy it was to root them.
Yeah.
And I guess it's, you know, the fact that there's still so many disparate versions of Android out there, it's still making it easy for that to happen. I think once Google starts forcing people to use, you know, the latest versions for their handsets, we'll start seeing the same thing with iOS that we're seeing with Android.
Well, I think part of the, I think it's also part of the deal. You know, the handset manufacturers are selling to the, you know, the handset manufacturers sell to the carriers, and the handset manufacturers and carriers can strike some deals about what's on that phone.
Right.
And so they want it to be, you know, as a carrier, you want, you know, as a carrier, they want as much control as they can get on the handset as they can. I mean, for a long time, I remember, you know, especially in Verizon, you couldn't bring something that you didn't buy from them.
Right. Right.
And part of that was they weren't sure whether they trusted it on their network. They'd been in control of the handsets for so long. But I think that there's, you know, I don't know, the telemetry coming out of a handset is so huge.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, we haven't started yet, have we?
Yeah, technically we started. I'm going to make an intro and then I'm going to say, well, I started off by asking him this, and then that's the way we'll do it.
Okay. So,
well, yeah.
Cool.
If you'd have done anything particularly inflammatory, I probably would have blanked that and then we'd have gone on. So.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think that I think it may be somewhat hard for Google to get that level of control. I think it's part of the reason they're making their own, they are, you know, making their own handsets, as it were. And
yeah.
I say as it were, because it's clear they're still using partners,
mm-hmm.
but they're insisting on owning the branding now on the devices and
yeah.
on having last word on the devices, on the way the devices are implemented and what software is on there. And, you know, I think that's because they want what Apple has, but
right.
Outside of those devices, I think it's between the handset manufacturer and the carrier, and they're deciding what kinds of extra software they'd like to put on and what the business models are between it and behind having those installed.
Yep.
So I think it's going to be hard for, it's going to be hard for Google at some point to get real control of Android.
Well, I think they screwed that particular pooch by trying to gain the market share that iOS had, because Apple was like, no, we're going to control everything. And Google's like, no, we're going to let you do that. You know, Google, you know, we'll let you put out whatever you want on whatever version of OS. And now it's coming back to bite them, because they didn't, I want to say they weren't thinking long term, but they probably weren't thinking long term that, you know, how OEMs would treat the disparate versions of Android. I mean, there's some, my daughter, her Android phone right now still run like Android 6, and,
wow.
and she's not getting updates, and she won't get updates because it's not worth it for them to spend the time and effort to push that out to a phone that arguably is no longer being sold. You can't find it anywhere. So,
yeah. I mean, I think that's true, honestly, of Android phones that aren't too, that aren't all that old. I mean, you might, I think I saw Android phones that were, and don't quote me on this, we're not recording this, are we? But, you know, a three-year-old Android phone might no longer get updates even when it's one of Google's devices.
Right.
I think when I was trying to figure out which phone handset to buy someone as a gift, who hadn't ever had a smartphone, I was trying to choose between the, you know, iPhone devices, which are pretty darn expensive,
mm-hmm.
and then the Android devices, you know, which are certainly cheaper and you've got a little more control over it. And I realized that some of the cost difference became how many years of support would I have on each one.
Right.
Because each one is not going to be supported by an operating system a lot sooner than any PC, than any computer ever would be. I mean, it takes,
yep.
you know, if you look at, most PCs aren't end of life on Windows. Windows will keep running on them.
Right.
Linux sure as hell run on, well, you know, you can get Linux distributions to install on anything that's, you know, 20 years old.
Yep.
But, you know, Apple's basically said, okay, after N years, we won't allow you to put the new operating systems on this hardware.
Yep.
But it's still a lot more years. You still get a lot more years of support on, you know, on computers than you do on phones. And I don't want to talk about why that is, because I'm not sure. But it was definitely part of my buying decision. I mean, honestly, I would likely not buy anyone an Android phone outside of the Nexus and Pixel phones, mm-hmm. where Google is, you know, where Google's got a fairly long time that they're, you know, they're promising to update.
Right.
And you know that the Lineage OS and some of the other forks will still work on them.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think for a, you know, yeah, I think for a toy phone, I might, you know, for a lab phone, sure. Buy anything, and as long as it's supported by Lineage OS, I that sounds like a great lab phone. But
yep. Yeah, nothing for your corporate environment, I would imagine. So
oh hell no.
so
no.
Yeah, so I actually went to HushCon this year. As I told about everybody who I talked to at HushCon, I couldn't go last year because we had snow up here in my house and I couldn't get down the hill to Seattle. It was actually a beautiful day. It was very cold. It wasn't very cold, but it was in the, you know, low 40s. It was about 5-6 C out here. So it was nice though. A lot of good talks, a lot of nice talks. The first talk I saw had to do with I remember Saturday's talk about fuzzing windows, which I actually did not know that there are not any like unified fuzzing frameworks for Windows fuzzing. I did not know that. There's like a number of ones that do certain things, but they don't all get together and do the same, you know, they aren't unified in any way.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, fuzzing is not my area, but I always imagined that Peach Fuzzer would do any of them. Would get very wide coverage just given that given the experience of its authors.
Yeah. So this guy was he was talking about a application that he was using to kind of umbrella all of the various types of ones out there into this one deal. What was his name? I forget. Let me go look at the schedule. It was Adam of DC949 on Twitter. Adam of DC949. He was talking about Windows fuzzing. And he had a product called Concierge that he was touting that you could, there was a GitHub on it. I have it in my I think I have it in my email because I was taking email notes. That's what I was reduced to. So
being unable to record.
Yeah, being unable to record. Yeah, that. So there. No, that's not Modular Chatbot. That's not it. It's on there somewhere. I'll have to find it. But yeah, it was very interesting because fuzzing is not my deal either. And apparently there's so many better like fuzzing tools for Linux, but and even some for OS X, but not so much for Windows, which I found quite odd. So
sure.
The talks were very good. The Lambert stuff was very good too. There's been some blog posts about Black Lambert, which is a malware. It's a framework for creating malware. And there was a number of different flavors that this guy was talking about. There's a link in our show notes from SecureList, Unraveling the Lambert's Toolkit from April. And he was talking about how advanced threat actors use these to infiltrate victims. So they have Black Lambert, White Lambert, Blue Lambert, Green Lambert, Pink Lambert, Gray Lambert. A guy used to work for a company that may or may not be in this document. I didn't want to mention where he worked at, but he was talking about how the different detections were there and how they figured out, you know, where to find these various bits. To be honest, some of these talks were so technical they kind of went over my head, which isn't hard to do for me, to be honest. But
well, they went in a number of. I think they covered a bunch of, a whole bunch of different areas. It's a little bit like having a conference. It's a little bit like if you go to a Black Hat or one of the other, you know, many track conferences, mm-hmm. where they're covering whole separate specialties. You know, you go to one room and it'll all be in one specialty, and you go to another room, it'll all be another. And so, you know, one room might be about reversing malware, and you'll have a whole group of, you know, you'll have a whole group of people that's incredibly active in that room looking at the, you know, watching and participating in the talks. And then you'll go to another room and that's entirely network red teamers.
Yeah.
And, you know, they'll also be very, very deep. But then the intersection between the people who do each of those two is nowhere near, it's nowhere near 100% of either population. It's far, far less.
Yeah.
And you know, for that matter, if someone has skill, if someone has skill and background in one in reverse engineering, then they're very often, you know, they very often either, if they do have some skill and background in red teaming, then it's gotten out of date, or vice versa, because both of those are moving so freaking fast.
Yep.
I mean, I think that's one of the, that's one of the interesting things in InfoSec, is that this field used to be a lot smaller. I got into it in, you know, 1999, and as the field's grown massively, with so many more people in it, with so much more going on, you know, so many more employers or so many more clients, the specialization has continued more and more and more. Right. And the thing that I see when I talk to people, you know, when you really, you know, when you get down and have beers with someone, and, or whatever it is that makes them, you know, that makes them really honest, what you find is that everybody in InfoSec seems to share this kind of back of our mind, this kind of back of our mind fear or worry or problem. And that's that we're all a little worried that, like, wait, I should know those things too. And I should know that area over there too. And that area over there too. Or I do know those areas, but I'm novice in those, and I'm, you know, and I'm really strong in my specialty and only in one other specialty. But there's so many things that we used to just all call InfoSec. And now, you know, and over time we've specialized so much that I think to some extent, and we all, you know, it's pretty deep down, because we're all just busy doing whatever we're doing. But I think that it's one of those things, and I've seen it in, you know, in talking to people who are in medicine as well, where we're all a little worried that we don't know enough of the other, you know, of the other specialties or of the other parts of our field. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really natural. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. And I do think that that fear and worry, though, is nice, because it keeps us staying at least a little up to date in all the other specialties.
Right.
So,
right.
The big one for me, you know, the question I have to ask myself all year, and the reason I bring this up is I keep having this conversation with other people who say the same thing, is all year long, what I've been doing is basically saying, okay, I'm, you know, wow, I should know something about that, you know, I want to follow that. I used to know how to do that or what have you. And I keep having to say, okay, what three things or what five things am I going to focus on this year? Like in my own continuing, ongoing training, because it doesn't matter, you know, who you are, you're either doing ongoing training, you know, whether it's self-training, screwing around with things on command lines, or, you know, or reading books or sitting in training classes, whatever. If you're not doing any kind of ongoing self-training, then you're just starting to fall behind a little bit more and a little mm-hmm. bit more. And yeah. that, but I have to keep triaging and saying, okay, where are my priorities? Which things are most important to me to stay up to date on, and to ideally try to expand the state of the art on.
Yep. Okay.
And so I keep pulling out of that. But so I think that was part of what I saw at HushCon, is that breadth.
Yep.
So I guess I'm going off on a little bit of a tangent. I liked the conference. I liked that there were two different talks that were done, at least two talks. I saw two of them that were done in costume.
Yes.
There was there was one talk done by Sharks, and there was another talk done by BB-8s, by Star Wars BB-8s. And those were both really, really neat. You know, they gave their talks as these, they gave, the people who gave these talks gave them in costume, potentially because they wanted to talk about something off the record and be so fully off the record that their identity wasn't exposed.
Right.
Kind of rocking back to the old days where, you know, people had handles and you really only knew their handles.
Yep.
But you know, I think the other part was it just created some fun. So one of my favorite talks was, you know, I had two talks I liked a lot. One of them was done by the BB-8s, and both of the two talks I liked a lot, I don't remember the names of the people who gave them, but were really focused on all of this DevOps that's going on. You know, it was really focused on attacking mm-hmm. on people who were, whether they were outside consulting firms like we are at Inguardians, or whether they were internal red teams, you know, like you see at so many companies, they were, you know, their job was to basically attack their, you know, was to basically attack a company. And what they found when they were attacking the company, was that the all the developers were just so helpful. Were just so helpful to the attackers. They were, you know, so they both kind of looked at a lot of the failures of DevOps, and the one that, one of the ones that just kind of blew my mind was the sheer amount of stuff that goes up on GitHub, the sheer number of credentials up on GitHub, the sheer number of, you know, of this should be secret that's up on a public GitHub.
Right.
And I saw all kinds of other things I really liked a lot. But the quote that I remember from the BB8 talk was, you know, to always look at GitHub's gists. He called gists the post-it note for DevOps. That wonderful post-it note on the monitor that has the credentials. And I, you know, heard about a whole bunch of sites that I'd, some of which I'd heard of and some of which I hadn't, you know, and projects. One of them, another GitHub related one, was called GitHump, and GitHump would, you give GitHump the domain name for a company, and it trolls, and it scrapes GitHub and finds all of the email addresses from the commit messages for all that company's repositories. Now you've got email addresses for developers, and now if you go searching based on those email addresses, you might find it starts telling you where you can use all that useful stuff that you found on GitHub or that you found. And that was part of a talk that was on OSINT, that was on open source intelligence, but it was just an amazing talk because, you know, similar to what happens at InGuardians and what happens at so many other consulting companies, there are times where just, you know, the logistics of an engagement, you know, when you're doing this kind of short haul consulting, the logistics of an engagement aren't always pinned down by the day you're supposed to start. And it's about the most frustrating thing to the people who are doing the work. It's not great. It's not great for the schedule. It's not great for the client. But, you know, every now and then you have something where it's Monday, the team's supposed to start hacking on somebody, and we don't have a signed contract, and so we can't start because that wouldn't be okay.
Right.
And so what this pair of BB8s did in one of their employers was, you know, they were told, like, hey, we don't have the contract, we may not have it for the week. Do whatever you're allowed to do without a contract, you know, which comes down to basically OSINT and maybe some port scanning.
Right.
And so they did OSINT, and they just used the web. They just used web searches and so on. They just used web-based tools. They didn't do any direct attacks. And by the time at the end of the week when the contract was signed and it was like, okay, you can start, they had the credentials they needed and the endpoint they needed to compromise, to complete the engagement. So they hacked the company solely by OSINT. And they went through their whole process, and it was a many-step process. And in the end, it ended up with you know, SSH keys, with the right set of SSH keys in GitHub.
Yeah.
And but there was a heck of a lot that they went through, and it was really thorough. I mean, like, if I were a client who got that report, I feel like I got a really good effort. I'd be pretty happy about it. So
yeah.
I don't know if they had to keep going and do more of a network-based test or what have you, but they had the keys to the kingdom, as it were, solely from OSINT, and that was a really good reminder of what you can do with OSINT. And I saw a bunch of different cool tools. One was a MaxMind website that lets you pull down all of the AS numbers for the internet, in essence, and all the IP addresses that match them by company name, so you could find out what the address space is for the company you're going after.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts off with NASA. I think it, you know, when you go there first, it starts off with NASA as an example. And there was another website called PTR Archive, which was an archive of reverse DNS records. So you pick a company name and you get their reverse DNS, not all of it, but for whatever's been recorded, and it's been recorded, I think, for more than a decade. Maybe it's 9 years. I think it might have been 2008.
Mm-hmm. 2008 to present. Stuff. Yeah, 43 billion records from 2008 to present.
Yeah. So that was, PTR Archive was really cool. Hunter.io, and I knew about data.com, which is kind of a Salesforce-based thing where you can get lists of employees and positions. But there was another website called Hunter.io where you could get, where you could basically say, I want email addresses at this company, and you get a whole bunch that have been voluntarily sent in, And you get them either by paying or by submitting some of your own. Like you get so many for free to start.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of fascinating because you could see things in there that weren't for sysadmins, and that sometimes were for, you know, pretty high ranking people at a company, and not just their developers, their system administrators. So I don't know, that talk was just really, really neat. It just went through all kinds of stuff. One of the biggest takeaways I had from it, outside of stop every now and then, if you're a defender, and we all are defenders, right? I mean,
right.
It's even if you say your job is to be a red teamer, it's like, well, you've got infrastructure, you've got your own computers. If you're using a computer, you're a defender. So the thing I got, one of my big takeaways from this was, if you're a defender, stop and, you know, do OSINT on yourself,
right?
Or, you know, trade with a friend and ask them to do OSINT on you while you do OSINT on them, and take a look at what you each found, and yep. And then decide what you're going to do about it. The other big one for me, it's a smaller one, is just this reminder about how much stuff is in S3 buckets or is in cloud-based storage, publicly accessible. And that's just like every organization should be looking to find out what about them, you know, what about them's in S3, mm-hmm. and not just Amazon's S3, but the other services, the other mainstream services as well. Like, I think we focus on Amazon a whole lot just because they're the Kleenex of many of the cloud services.
Wow, that's such a nice visual there. Okay.
Oh yeah. Boy. Yeah. I'm.
No,
you find the metaphor.
I was just thinking blowing my nose on, yeah, whatever, but yeah.
It's, blowing your nose on S3.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or rather, S3 is the, maybe we should be saying S3 is the Kleenex of information technology. So if you were to shake it out, you might, you know,
get a lot of junk.
Some really scary boogers.
Oh yeah. Really scary. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A lot of people. Yeah. I mean, every time the new S3 comes out, the first thing that I know, a lot of my friends are like, hey, you need to check your permissions again, because those things get unset very easily for some reason. So it's interesting that, you know, those things don't get, aren't more permanent in their permission setting. So So HushCon's definitely worth the cost of admission is what you're trying to say.
Oh, I sure think HushCon's worth the cost of admission.
Yeah.
I mean, just to be clear, InGuardians likes it so much we sponsor it.
Ah,
it is, you know, we're one of many sponsors. But, you know, we don't have any financial stake in it. If HushCon were to make a ton of money, we wouldn't get anything. We just know that the community would have a good time.
Right.
So I think HushCon's really good. I've been going since before we sponsored, and I know the group of people that puts it on, and they are solid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're really solid. They've been in the information security community in Seattle for a very long time, and they really care about putting a really good conference on.
Cool. Yeah. So. Yeah. I've been going, well, this is the second time I've went, and I was really impressed with the venue this year too. It was good acoustics. You know, they seem to, you know, have a nice spread. The Lockpick Village was going quite well. And it was definitely worth it. I can't wear the shirt though at the office.
No, their shirts this year, not so good.
Yeah.
I think you know, one of my favorite, so my two favorite things about HushCon are basically, first, that the talks end up being really strong, and the fact that we're not being recorded, mm-hmm. means that people share things they wouldn't necessarily share at other conferences.
Right.
The other one is their CTF, their Capture the Flag, is actually really well liked. It's not easy, but it's not easy. I remember listening to what the winners of it this year said, and they were just, you know, they were very, you know, the number one and number two winners were very frustrated with it, with the difficulty.
Oh,
they had
okay.
a great time. They
yeah.
enjoyed it. They liked their prizes. But yeah, they're definitely frustrated with the difficulty of at least one of the challenges there. Well, so
that goes to the technical acumen of the organizers, because I think it was who made the, it was a virus and did Whitey help make that one? I forget.
I'm trying to remember. So it neither of them, they must have picked the couple who built it.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember the name of the couple who built it, and I'm really embarrassed, and I'm really hoping that somewhere right here, when you're editing, you will put their names in.
Yes, I hope I hope I can find that information.
I will make room for it right here. One of the authors was author one, and the other was I believe her handle was her handle or her real name somehow was Baby Doll.
Baby Doll. Okay.
And it was the Baby Doll. It was the Baby Doll CTF, I think was the name of it. Oh, or nice. At least was like the URL. So,
okay.
Yeah, those two put on, I recognized at least one of the two had put on the CTF in past years, and it gets talked about really, it gets talked about a lot. People really think it's strong.
Nice.
So.
Nice. All right. Well, I actually had something I wanted to ask you before we go, because we also have some audio after this. Miss Amanda went to B-Sides Wellington, so I'm going to put the audio from that she's got on after this. But so last week, we talked about the incident response hierarchy of needs, and you are a company that comes in and does red teaming, pen testing. You really stress the environment that you're coming into, to the point where sometimes you often find things that you didn't cause and require people to have to roll incident response because you found naughty bits going on in there.
Certainly.
So Matt Swan, we talked about him last week, works at a company up here in the Seattle area. It's a fairly well-known company. So he created this hierarchy of needs for incident response people, and it starts off with, various levels, all the way from, knowing what's inside your, what assets you're defending, all the way up to, are you collaborating with competitors to understand and disrupt adversary campaigns? For the majority of the companies that you go into, what level are they on this list? And there's a link in the show notes to the hierarchy. It seems to me, and tell me if I'm wrong, that a lot of companies like to play in the middle, but they don't handle the bottom part of the pyramid, which arguably is more important, in my opinion, wealth. They like to play in the area that's kind of, sexy with the machine and intelligence and the threat intelligence, but they don't do what's necessary to complete the pyramid. Am I wrong in that assessment?
I don't think you're wrong. I would say, in some ways, I think you may be giving companies a little too much credit, and it's a less subtle. My point would be unfortunately less subtle, but I think that when I'm looking at this hierarchy, I think that most companies are just barely covering detection, and they're usually not covering detection very well.
Mm.
And heck, a lot of the companies that we've gone into don't have any detection in place at all. Like, they might have the tools, but they don't have the time.
Right.
And so what we'll go in and we'll say, wow, we've gotten, and I've talked to a number of other firms, and they have the same experience. They go in, and by the end of the week, they've fully compromised the environment. They got, we usually end up in a Windows environment, as an example. We end up with domain admin on the first day, maybe on the second day. Some clients have taken us almost a full week, but usually we're getting domain admin early on, and the rest of the week is spent using it. And in using it, we start to, as the week goes on, we try to amp up the amount of logging that we're going to generate. We're trying to be less sneaky and then less sneaky, and then eventually just get to being loud.
Right.
And trying to gauge what our client's detection capability is, so we can give them advice on what they should do there. And some clients say, yeah, we're on day five and we caught, and by the fifth day, they've been able to figure out what we did on the first day or the second day, or they finally seen something really loud. But, but other clients, they're not seeing it at all. They didn't see anything. And that's not to say they're lacking the skills. It's generally that they're lacking the time.
Right.
And some of that, you know, the bolt, you know, some of that time they're lacking is the time it takes to get their tools out of default configurations. Mm-hmm. And you gotta get your tools out of default configurations because every attack tool has been written to, you know, every tool has been written to try to evade the default configuration. But you got to get it out of default configuration and tune it for your environment. And most organizations, you know, that have the tools haven't tuned for that.
Right.
Because they haven't been allocated the time. I don't want to say that the practitioners are the ones who have to change what they're doing. It's more that, you know, someone up the management chain has to say, we're going to put time into this. We're going to make it a priority. It's not urgent, but it's important. And that's, of course, the hardest part of, you know, I'd say of work and IT in specific, but work in general is putting the important, is making sure that the important isn't drowned out by the urgent.
Right.
Because that urgency and importance is, you know, those are perpendicular or orthogonal qualities. But the other part of having the time is having the time to go look at the logs and the tools. You know, again, I don't think it's useful to blame the IT organizations at a company because I don't think blame is the most useful thing anyway. If you want to make things better, it tends to make people defensive, at which point they're not collaborating to make things better. They're just trying to make sure the blame doesn't land on them.
Right.
But you know, if you were to think about where you could take action best, or who you'd want to talk to convince them to take, you know, different actions, it'd be higher up the management chain where the time and money are allocated. And just basically saying, listen, you want to have staff for, you know, you want to have staff for this, you want to have staff spending their time on this, and you want it to be at this point of priority among all the other priorities.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, so anyway, I think most organizations aren't even really getting the bottom of this pyramid. They don't have their detections fairly, their detection is usually immature. And it's usually just understaffed.
Is it an over reliance on, say, MSSPs, or do you walk in and you go, well, we did X, Y, and Z. We owned you after 6 hours. We had domain admin. And do you have people look around and go, well, why didn't our MSSP tell us, or why didn't, you know, our endpoint security, you know, let us know that this happened? Is it an over reliance on a party or a third party or a tool thinking that it's going to tell them that it's going to solve all of our problems? That's why we spent $500,000 getting this, you know, organization in here. Is that what you're seeing?
Sure. Well, let me speak to the tool first. Right. So, you know, I think that most organizations have really good tools that have never been tuned. And you know, one of the things that we've done, and I don't want to advertise our services. So let me find another way to put it. One of the things that consulting companies have done that we've had a part in, but there are lots of other parties that can do this, is to go in and say, here, we will run an attack, but we'll run it one step at a time, and we'll take, you know, we will say, okay, we're going to do this thing. We're going to send you, you know, we're going to send you one idea might be, we're going to send you some macro laden emails, mm-hmm. and phishing emails. And now, let's look at the different controls that you have that can try to block that or that can try to detect it and see, what did you see? And we realize, okay, in the default configuration, you don't see that. And we say, okay, why don't you try, you know, flip that knob, as it were. And they flip the knob and they're like, okay, now you're seeing half of what we're sending through.
Right.
Let's look at that console. And you basically get the attacker and the defender together, actually seeing how the defender can catch the attacker.
Yeah.
Because it's plenty of fun for all of us on the, you know, all of us on the red side to basically go attacking and say, ah, oh, they never even saw me. Ha ha ha. But the more useful thing is to say, I helped it. By the time I left at the end of a 1 week, we call it a purple team. Mm-hmm. By the end of the purple team engagement, there are things that they couldn't catch that they can now catch. Okay. And there are things that there are attacks that worked that now no longer work.
Right.
So that's, Yeah, I think so. I think first and, you know, first and foremost, a lot of organizations have the tools. They may even have the people, but they have to spend the, but they have to prioritize tuning all those tools and creating whatever process they need to catch stuff.
Yeah.
On the MSSP side, there's just such a huge difference in quality between between what you get from the MSSPs. Mm-hmm. And I think to some extent, it's the tough one is that because MSSPs were a checkbox, there's been a race to the bottom.
Right.
Like, you know, I mean, the MSSP at its core says, I want to have monitoring. I don't want to spend the money to have my own 24/7 monitoring team. Mm-hmm. I think if I get somebody else, they can do this cheaper. Maybe they can do it better. But the idea at the very least is, you know, similar to like if you're fairly well to do and you own a fractional aircraft ownership, what you're really saying is not, I don't want to own a plane. You're just saying, I want to own a plane, but I don't want it to cost that much.
Right.
And unfortunately, I think that's the MSSP model. You're basically looking at, you know, you're looking at two different vendors and the two different vendors know that if you have some monitoring, it'll check your box. And now they're trying to compete on price.
Right.
And that's kind of, you know, that's made it so that some of them are still pretty good, but I think a lot of them, you know, the market pushes them to drop the number of staff per client or the fractional number of staff per client.
Yep. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, and the old adage is you get what you pay for. If you're trying to find the cheapest version, you're going to get what you expect or what you should expect. Yeah. So,
I mean, there's got to be an MSSP sweet spot, right? There should be, it should certainly be that, you know, that, I mean, I remember when Counterpain first came out, and I remember, you know, you should be able to go to an outside, you know, you should be able to go to an outside company and, you know, and have them staff your incident response and somebody else's, you know, mm-hmm. three companies, and each one of you basically pays for one shift. I'm eliminating the profit model, but, you know, each one of you pays for one shift, and now you've got 24/7 coverage at, you know, at the cost of one shift of coverage.
Right.
Yeah. So I think it's a hard one.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what I'll say, actually, if you want to talk either the ransomware that we saw this year, as we're getting to the end of the year and it's been a banner year in ransomware sometime, I'd love to. If you want to talk Linux hardening sometime, I'd love to do that too.
Yeah. Last time actually we talked to you was just before your class in Vegas. How did that go?
The Black Hat class went really, really well. I got some of the best reviews that I've gotten, and I've been teaching some version of that class at conferences since around 2000, and it went really, really well. We had a great class. We cover a lot in 2 days, and I'm even thinking about, you know, maybe I need to reduce the amount that we cover so that it's not quite so fast. But we had a great time. We do a lot of exercises, and this year I'm going to do something that I've been doing in blog posts and webinars and all that, webcasts, and basically make more of the class, more of the exercises for the class, basically, you know, CTFs. Uh-huh. Where it's like, okay, I've just shown you how to break an attack. Now for the exercise, figure out how to attack this VM I've just given you, and then go and use what we just learned to break that. And then, you know, potentially culminating in a live fire exercise with teams. But I'm really enjoying this idea of being really, really practical. And that's what we did. That's what we started doing in the class this year, of making the exercises really, really practical, where we're not just showing them how to set up the defenses, but also showing them that they were helping them see that their defenses were effective by having them attack a system beforehand.
Nice.
Do the defense and then attack it again after. And that's kind of a blast. I really enjoyed how much fun the students were having. You know, and I always learn something from teaching those classes. I always hear about people's environments and that's where I've learned a lot about about DevOps and how what's different in those spaces and how what we've been doing, you know, we're transitioning to that. Every year put something new in it. So I think this year we'll be looking at Kubernetes, which has just been taking the world by storm lately. I mean, it's been going on for a while, but it's just picking up more and more speed, and mm-hmm. And you can lock it down. So
nice.
Pretty fun.
I wouldn't mind having a discussion about container security. I was looking online for you know that, but I think we probably need to make that for another podcast.
Another day, yeah.
Yeah, another day. So Jay, if people wanted to, you know, watch your workshops, because I have seen them, they're very good. How would people go about signing up for those? Do you have anything coming up soon?
Sure. Watch my Twitter feed and In Guardian's Twitter feed, and we'll definitely be putting up notices of anything. I've got one of these workshops coming up in about a week and a half, I think. So roughly the 28th. Wow, I probably should probably should keep track of that. I mean, it's in my calendar, but I probably should like be ready to say that off the top of my head. So on the morning of the 28th, it's like 10 a.m. Pacific and 1 p.m. Eastern. I'm going to do another one of these webinars that Beyond Trust sponsors. It's another in a series of attack and defense, basically taking a Linux capture the flag system and showing how do you attack it, and then how do you use best practices or, you know, or known Linux lockdown technologies to break the attack.
Okay.
So I'm doing one of those then, and I'm doing another one like that online in March. And honestly, if you watch Twitter, I'll probably have something in between those two sometime. I do this a lot, and I'm having a lot of fun with it.
Sounds great. Okay. So you're on Twitter at Jay Beale. That's J A Y B E A L E, right?
You got it.
Okay.
And you can also watch In Guardians. So at I N and then Guardians. Anything I do or anything the other members in the In Guardians team do is on there. We have all kinds of cool stuff that people post up. So you can see some cool hardware hacking. You can see some Linux stack and defense. You can see some Windows stuff.
Very nice.
Thank you.
All right. Well, Jay, thank you for coming on. We definitely would like to have you on to talk about the container security thing. And I know Mr. Betcher would probably love to have you on to talk about the malware stuff. So, we'll definitely get that on in the next year.
That'd be great. Cool. Thanks a lot.
All right. Well, that was it for Jay. Stay tuned in a few seconds and you'll hear Miss Amanda's audio from B-Sides Wellington. Okay.
Hello, this is Amanda from BreakSec, and I am here at B-Sides Wellington with a group of wonderful young gentlemen.
And Ben.
And Ben. We're gonna go around and introduce ourselves and then talk a little bit about the conference. So first up.
Hi, I'm Chris Blunt. I'm one of the organizers of B-Sides Wellington.
Hi, I'm Ollie. I'm a security engineer, and I was talking about public Wi-Fi and how to stay safe on the internet.
Ben?
Hi, I'm Ben. I just attend conferences.
Thanks, Ben.
But you also gave an excellent talk yesterday.
It's excellent.
Ben accidentally got up on stage and talked about imposter syndrome, which we all seem to always have. I just gave my two talks, and Wellington is absolutely gorgeous, and I know everybody that's listening was super, super jealous that I got to come. So, first off, tell me what your favorite part of the conference is. What's your favorite part about organizing a conference?
Getting near to completion, I guess. But I think it's gone reasonably smoothly, so I think we've been really lucky. And everyone seems to have enjoyed themselves, which is cool.
About how many people do we have?
Just under 600, which for a first con is pretty impressive, I'd say.
Yeah. And we highly recommend everybody comes next year. We're going to do it next year?
Bit early to say whether I'm doing it next year.
For anybody that's organized a conference, I can definitely agree with that.
Maybe I'll get some sleep and decide whether or not I'm stupid enough to do it again next year.
It's type 2 fun, right? Like, it's scary at the time, and then once it's over, you're like, yeah, that was great, let's do that again.
Yeah. I think once I've forgotten the pain, it will be okay.
Yeah.
It's a glowing review of putting on a conference. Once the pain subsides, it's lovely.
Yeah.
We're just security masochists, that's why.
Once I can just bask in the glory of having successfully delivered what appears to be a pretty cool con. Yeah.
Right, right.
I'll decide to do it all again next year.
Retire at peace.
It's like having children. Like, you go through all of that pain, and then you kind of forget how bad it is. I mean, it depends on if they survive or not. It's totally different. never mind. I probably should take that part out. I'm going to offend somebody else. what was your favorite part?
I was really impressed with the range of talks, and also the just the B-sides, like inclusiveness and trying to get a range of speakers and a range of topics that weren't just all technical, which is a far cry from some of the other conferences I've been to in the past. So.
Yeah. So this was your first conference. You said you went to a couple at work, but
yeah, I've been to a couple of other conferences.
Okay. All right. Very cool. Ben, what was your favorite part?
My favorite... I was really stoked when looking at the CFP page of the wide variety of talks there that weren't just like, show us your mad 0 day, because that happens all the time, and cool. Actually talking about things that affect the industry rather than things that affect a current install of whatever operating system until it gets patched. Not to diss on research, because it's good, but it's pretty catered for in the rest of the industry. How chill is foretold New Zealand is, and that is very reflected in the attitudes of the conference.
The keynote was all about communication within the workplace too, all of that stuff's super important and we never hear enough about it.
So I've really enjoyed that. It's felt, if anyone's been to any of the DevOps Days events, it's kind of been similar in that to let's actually talk about things that matter rather than things that we can showboat about, and there hasn't been much showboating in terms of even the red team bros have been lovely, which is not a thing I expected to ever say, but I don't know whether that's just a byproduct of New Zealand.
Yeah, I think probably somewhat.
So we actually rewrote our CFP page several times, and I was responsible for doing that. And the one thing that we wanted to get away from was a BroCon or a tech BroCon.
Right.
We purposely wanted to address some of the issues, some of which, as those of you that were in the room yesterday will know, I'm personally affected by, and have been severely affected by this year. So it was really important to me and for the other organisers. I'm going to give them a shout out now. So Sput, Erica, SecValve, who's Kate, and Scooch, who will kill me if I reveal his real name.
It's
Lachlan.
Such a
Kiwi
name, it's so good.
We felt it was really important to cover a broad range of subjects, and we felt it was really important to create a conference that we would want to attend, and that would appeal to a broad range of people from inside the InfoSec industry and across the wider tech industry. And I think we've achieved that. I'd like to think we have. People,
this is one of the most diverse conferences I think that I've been to. Yeah. It's fantastic.
Of the B-sides I've been to, this is definitely hit all those points the most by far.
Yeah. So. And then the other point for us was to attract diversity in terms of gender and, where possible, other underrepresented groups within the industry, both in terms of attendees and speakers, and I think we've been pretty successful in that as well. We were doing the stats this morning, and 31% of our speakers are female, which
way higher than the industry average.
All the women from
All of us are.
That's the way it seems, right?
To other speaker lineups, yes.
But it's the same with the attendees. I think we've got an impressive balance or mix of people that are attending as well. it's not all dudes wearing black hoodies. Although we have our fair share of them, you know, there's a good smattering of color.
And, I mean, we're selling black hoodies, so I mean,
yeah, and gold ones, but nobody seemed to want them.
Incidentally, it's also the first tech conference I've ever been to that has brightly colored merch. So
it's amazing. I wish more people would do it. I have so many black t-shirts.
Yep. I heard there was a line for the women's restroom at some point, which is like
a complaint. Obviously.
No, which is like a.
That's a bomb.
Yeah, it's like a thing you don't get at security conferences.
Normally, we have the bathrooms to ourselves.
Yeah. I assume that's just because there's one stall in there, rather.
Nope,
than like,
no, there's like 50. Yeah, like 50 stalls, and all to ourselves. It's nice. Wonderful. So, Ben, what did you talk about? Your speaker.
I talked about imposter syndrome, which I'll jokingly say I have no right to talk about. And how that affects people in the industry, and how that's affected me, and has affected certainly people around me, and what we can do as an industry to try and reduce that, which will make our industry better. We'll go a long way to getting more people in, which will solve the ever impending doom of not being able to hire enough security people. It turns out, if you're just less of an ass to them, you can hire more people.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Who in the industry knew? About 12 people. So that was kind of really it, which was good to be able to talk about, and it's been really well received. The feedback has been really positive, and lots of people saying, I'm glad that people are talking about this, and I thought it was just me, which is the outcome of you want from that talk.
Right. Do you have any, like, without having people not go watch your talk later online, do you have any, like, quick things that they could do to kind of combat imposter syndrome? Like, did you have anything listed, like, good ideas to...
I mean...
Other than not being an asshole?
Yeah, I mean, that's often put on, and, like, we had that at Etsy of, like, don't hire assholes, but it's a really hard question to interview for. Like, are you an asshole? Yes. Oh, you failed the interview.
But there's different kinds of assholes.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, there's ones that I can deal with.
Yeah.
And there's ones that
there's brilliant assholes,
can't.
And
right.
Then, yeah.
Right.
But how do you deal with the ones that don't even realize themselves that they're assholes?
Leave.
Yeah, I'm just, like, a subset of this is, as both the security industry and the tech industry, we should talk about interviewing, because it's a thing what you do in your job, even though your job you learned to do in your bedroom by breaking computers, and you are automatically assumed you know how to interview people when you've had little to no training on it, and there's no measures on it, and everyone assumes, like, driving they're above average.
I am, though. Like, I'm great at driving.
I loathe interviewing, and I'm a terrible driver. I should not let me be behind the wheel of a car. But if we, like, interview better, then we can filter out some of that. But you also need, interviewing is only half of it, and, like, people leave the industry because it's terrible, not because their interview went badly.
Right.
So the Recurse Center's rule, social norms and social rules of no subtle isms like racism, sexism, no feigning surprise of, like, I can't believe you didn't know that, you're such a blah blah blah.
Right.
I hope I didn't forget them, as all my hacker school friends would disown me. And the other two that you can look on their website for are really good places to start, I would say.
Very cool.
Yeah.
All right, Ali, what about your talk?
I just talked about public Wi-Fi and how to, like, just Wi-Fi security in general, and okay, how to stay safe on the internet.
All right. Very cool.
And then, yeah.
The things that lots of people need, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. Just basic things, like,
right,
making sure you're using encryption, whether that you're hosting a website or accessing someone else's site. There's a great browser extension called HTTPS Everywhere, which AFF built something.
Okay.
Which helps with that as well. And
what does that do?
It just makes sure that you're accessing the HTTPS version of the website if it's there, and remembers that for next time as well.
Okay, all right, very cool. All right, anybody else have anything else you want to talk about while we're here? Awesome weather here in New Zealand.
Oh, we picked the best. For all those that are coming in from outside of Wellington, probably don't realize that this is not the weather we have all the time.
I was told that it's normally, like, hurricane gale winds, and,
it is like this, like, for a good good part of the summer. It also changes throughout the day, so you know, you'll go to work in the morning and it'll be like freezing and raining, and then by lunchtime it's like this and you can go outside for lunch. It's great.
It's like the Crowded House song, Four Seasons in One Day.
Yeah.
It's literally true. I don't know. I think that for me, the only thing that I would say is that if you're putting on a con, and if you're organising a conference, then you need to think about subjects that aren't tech focused, such as mental health, like imposter syndrome and contempt culture, and those things that people can really learn from, and communication as well, just the basic talk about communication and language, things that we all forget about. And we all have our own styles in, but we maybe don't necessarily see other people's points of view on them.
Yeah, and I would really like other conferences to just kind of start doing that. It's as somebody that's, I don't consider myself super technical in any aspect, so it's hard sometimes to put in CFPs because I feel like everything that I'm going to talk about, other people have talked about. Do you?
Yeah.
All right. Perfect. yeah, so... it would be nice for other conferences to kind of go along the same idea, open their minds to other ideas for CFPs.
Well, anyone that follows me on Twitter will see me ranting around the fact that we're not going to fix the InfoSec problem by training more people to be information security professionals. You know, I happen to be an information security professional, but I don't actually see that as my job. I think of myself as a business whisperer. Yeah. I talk to the business. I don't talk to the techies, because it's the business that has to understand what it is that they want to do.
Right.
IT is there, and information security professionals are there to serve the business and help them manage risk. I think we're a million miles away from the days where you could say no to the business and expect them to accept it. What we should be doing is supporting and enabling them to achieve their goals with a level of risk that they're willing to take.
Which takes more than technical skills to accomplish.
And even if we're not comfortable with that level of risk, if we provided the advice and it's been signed off by the person that truly owns the risk and is accountable for the risk, then we've done our job. Where we aren't doing our job is when we say, no, you can't do that because, oh, the risk is too risky and I won't let you do it. That is not my job, and it isn't anyone else that works in our industry's job. And I think we have to learn that we're here to help and support businesses, not to stop them from working.
Right, definitely.
And if anything that we do or recommend hinders users, and we shouldn't be surprised when the users bypass it in some way. After all, if we're hindering people, we're stopping them from being able to effectively do what they need to do. No matter how sane we think what we're doing is.
Yeah, right.
InfoSec has this somewhat self-deluding notion that it is the most important thing, which you would in like any part of your industry. But if you've looked at all the companies that have got really owned and then their stock price has gone up, that kind of proves that the business world doesn't give a shit how cool think you are. It cares how well you do business. And if you can have all your stuff owned but still sell lots of stuff, as a business, that is what matters. And security isn't the be-all and end-all, and it kind of is obvious because, like, your CSO isn't in charge of your company.
Right.
Turns out the CEO, then the CFO, is in charge of your company. so, like, saying no to the business would be like, yeah, cool, but we're doing this anyway because that way we can be a business, not... an academic example of how to do security, and it's like the compromise between those two.
A lot of people try and strive for the academic route,
it's
a great idea.
It's a lovely ideal. Yeah. No one wants to go like, well, we've made this 95% secure, because being the nerds we are, we're like, there's a 5% weakness. Yeah. Totally, the NSA will get in. But if you've gone from 0 to 95%, that's a bigger gain than going from 95 to 99.
Oh, yeah.
I'm no maths major, but I think those two numbers. That way around.
I'm not sure.
If like you can get someone from the maths review board to check those numbers.
Any of you listening are good at math and are incorrect.
Please write in.
Please.
Or fax.
What's your fax number?
415. I forget the rest. it's online now.
Right.
So yeah, I think understanding that we have to talk to the business rather than just releasing cool Python scripts and really interesting bits of C code, which like I love and grew up loving, but turns out in the business world, they're not as important as you think.
All right, so how can people go about contacting you if they want to talk about this stuff or how awesome New Zealand is?
Oh, they can find me on Twitter. It's at Chris Blunt. I've got a drawing of me that looks pretty much like me.
It looks like you, yeah.
So I've got a big beard and glasses, so you can't miss it.
All right, are you on Twitter?
I'm on everywhere where I want to be found on the internet at Ollie the Ninja, O-L-L-Y, the Ninja.
Awesome. Ben?
I'm mostly on MySpace and LO, so you can find me on there.
You're the last person on MySpace, aren't you?
My FidoNet address is 2.254/524.7, and my fax number is, I've just got to find it, it takes so long to look up on these things. My fax number is +1 41, oh, then my phone crashed.
Technology doesn't.
He will tweet out his fax number.
It's in my slides. You can find
it's
my
in your slides.
Yeah,
all right.
My fax number.
Perfect.
It's the easiest way to get in contact with me. I can DM
Amazing.
You my fax number if not.
Yes, please. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, and I'm so glad I got to come here. So, thanks again.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Background noise. That was me talking.